in South Africa relationship, and I realized then that the minister was here. And today we are discussing South Africa-US bilateral relationship. It was our desire that would have had somebody from the U.S. Embassy to be with us today to also make a presentation alongside the presentation that we are going to receive from the department. But I'm advised that they have I'm not sure what way to use, whether they have declined the invitation or they have found it inappropriate to come and speak to us for one reason or the other. They are not going to meet us to discuss that South Africa-US relation, which is unfortunate, because when you have a relationship with a person, when you are married with your wife and your wife refuses to discuss issues in the marriage, it becomes sad. So we ask the U.S. Embassy to share with us their own perspective of the relationship, and the advice from the secretary that they felt it appropriate not to take up that invitation. I'm expressing my disappointment to that, because it's quite unusual for any country to refuse the opportunity to speak to a country that they have a relationship with. The Portfolio Committee on Foreign Affairs has the constitutional obligation to do an oversight over the Department of Foreign Affairs, and therefore the custodian of foreign policy is the Department of Foreign Affairs, and therefore the relationship between countries is coordinated and managed by Foreign Affairs, and therefore it would have been appropriate for us to engage with the U.S. Office in this country to find out from them how they understand our relationship and how best can we improve those relationships, and if there are problems, what are those problems and how can we together deal with those problems. But they found it quite inappropriate for them to come and talk to us, which is, I said earlier, that is unusual, because all other countries, when you ask their ambassadors to come here, they will take the first opportunity to do that. Instead, others will make requests as to whether they could come and speak to the committee on this issue or that issue. It has always been a question of finding time to accommodate all the ambassadors that want to come and speak to the committee. I must indicate that this is not the first time that the U.S. has declined our invitation. It's actually the second time that they've declined our invitation. And that is very sad that they've done that on the second time. And maybe we should then at some point think whether are these the friends that we want to have that seek not to want to discuss with anyone, or these are the friends that have only interest and therefore they don't see a reason to build a relationship, but only to sit and pursue their own interests selfishly so, and not share anything with somebody else. With those words, honorable members, we have the department before us, and they are going to discuss with us South Africa USA relations, and I'm told that Ambassador Krobler is here, and they will be able, I've got to do that, the paper, I'll come back to you, and they will take us through a presentation. Ambassador, what we normally do is that we will allow you to make a presentation, and then after that take a group of questions and we can deal with those questions as they come. Honorable Seiko?
Chair, I want to know if you will then convey your disappointment to the U.S. Embassy, because indeed I think there are quite a number of issues that would have raised with the U.S. ambassador or representative. Thank you.
I think on behalf of the committee, I will do that. I will express our disappointment that it, or at least on two occasions, they have not taken up the invitation we have sought to give them to speak to us. So I will raise that with them. With that note, honourable members. Can we then give to the ambassador to take us through your presentation? Ambassador.
Chairperson, thank you very much for your introductory words. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be able to interact with the portfolio committee. As you're aware, we, the Foreign Affairs, the DFA, regard that as a very critical and important interaction for us. And as we were very happy recently to have had a team to visit us up in Gauteng, and which we regarded from our point as having been very constructive and a useful thing. But thank you very much for this opportunity. And thank you for this opportunity in particular to talk about our relations, bilateral relations with the United States. Let me say at the outset that our relations with the United States is comprehensive. It is constructive in many sectors, and I think that we can say that we have a constructive relationship with the United States. I had the opportunity to travel there with Prince Mbeki in December last year, and also, as you are aware, he was there the previous year in 2005 and had interactions with President Bush. I say that we have a constructive relationship, that does not mean or imply that we do not have areas of disagreement, that we do not have difference of opinion on certain issues, and we can come to that. But I think one can say that our relationship with the United States has reached a point of maturity that, in fact, we can agree to disagree on certain issues. I will also come back to that, but just say at the outset that the United States is a key, a superpower is a key player internationally with significant political and economic interests. Therefore, it is important for us to continue to work with the United States and to build a relationship with the U.S., despite the fact that we may have differences in certain areas. When we, perhaps as background, and this is nothing new, the U.S. foreign policy is very strongly driven by U.S. national interests. Of course, that's the case in most countries, all countries. Foreign policy is based on national interests. But I think in the case of the U.S., we have seen, after the tragic events of 9/11, that there has been a very, very strong focus on security issues, i.e. the so-called war on terror. President Bush, on the 29th of January 2002, in his State of the Union, made it very clear and referred to the so-called actors of evil, an alliance between terrorists and states such as North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, which alliance, he said at the time, I quote, was arming to threaten the peace of the world and, quote, pose a grave and growing danger. So the so-called Bush Doctrine became the cornerstone of the U.S.'s foreign policy and informed, very strongly informed, U.S. foreign policy to this day. In terms of this doctrine, the U.S. asserts the right and the intention to engage in preemptive war in response to their perceived threats, arguing that the, quote, prevailing concept of imminent threat, unquote, as a justification for the use of force under international law, and that prior U.S. foreign policy needed to be, quote-unquote, adapted due to the supposition that these so-called rogue states would rely on terror and potentially weapons of mass destruction to attack the U.S. That, in essence, constitutes the Bush Doctrine, and we to this day, as I say, strongly informed the U.S. Foreign policy. I think one can broadly say that, and frankly speaking, that there are three broad factors that drive U.S. foreign policy, and the one is obviously the whole issue of natural resources. Then there is the question of spreading democracy to other parts of the world, or exporting democracy to other parts of the world. And this includes, of course, the Middle East. And there is a strong interest, and it is one of the priorities of the Bush administration to find a solution to the Palestinian-Israel issue. And I'll come back to that because there's a conference planned in November this year. And then, of course, the expansion of U.S. political, military, and economic power. So, the bottom line there is the importance of the Bush Doctrine on its foreign policy. Just briefly, when one looks at the scenario currently in the U.S., we know that both houses are now in the hands of the Democrats, and it's increasingly difficult for the administration, given some of the or increasing low approval ratings, the discontentment in the country over Iraq. It makes it increasingly difficult for the Republicans or the Democrats to advance their competing agendas. The current administration is increasing stronger congressional opposition and significant push for greater oversight. There were some recent defeats in Israel, the recent shooting down of the immigration bill, which I think reflected the problems that the administration faced at this point. Analysts who look at the U.S. are saying that, looking at the State Department and U.S. foreign policy at this juncture, That's the whole issue of transformation diplomacy, or the so-called new approach, is more prevalent than now than the previous dispensation, where perhaps, or not previous dispensation, but the previous approach, where there was a very strong influence of the neocons, and analysts are saying that there is a greater embrace today in the U.S. in terms of its foreign policy, of a realpolitik, of a pragmatism, as opposed to the previously favored idealistic or ideological approach. And I think in the context also, the U.S. has had its problems with the U.N., but there seems to be a move towards perhaps engaging the U.N. and adopting a multilateralist approach more so than in the past. And I think this is evident in the case of North Korea, and also to an extent as far as Iran is concerned. It was interesting this morning, and many of you may have heard that there was some very tough talk by the French foreign minister on Iran, and alluding to the possibility of war, and that the U.S. in its department statement yesterday actually said that, or the U.S., the only solution, or that the preferred route, is still dialogue and diplomacy. So this is the situation in the U.S. As is perceived by us, that there is a more pragmatic approach and a move towards using multilateral organizations more so than before. What is, if I can just say something about foreign policy, what is the case of the fact that the U.S.'s image across the world today is not a very good one, and I think that everyone would agree with that. The fact is that recently the Marshall Fund in Germany, for instance, conducted a poll which showed that approximately 60% of all people in the EU now regard U.S. leadership as undesirable. Now, what has led to that is that I think the foreign policy, or the tenets of the foreign policy, as I explained earlier, has led to a situation where it's led to a deficit in morality in Europe, amongst others, the lack of trust, the question of legitimacy, that has caused great concern in other parts of the world. The Iraq issue is, and we can come back to that, but the Iraq issue has caused major problems for the U.S., not only internationally, but internally as well. In a way, it diverted attention from the serious situation in Afghanistan. It actually created a failed state in Iraq, which has become a breeding ground for terrorism increasingly. It also led to a situation where it's enhanced the mobilization of recruits for terrorism across the world. So this is one example of some of the problems that the U.S. is experiencing in terms of its foreign policy. When we come to the U.S. in Africa, we can go back to what the U.S. National Security Strategy was published in September 2002, stated that, quote, Africa's great size and diversity requires a security strategy that focuses on bilateral engagement and builds coalitions of the willing. Thus, it can then fall be expected that the U.S. will continue with its endeavors to spread its influence and its engagement on the African continent in key countries like South Africa, Nigeria, Kenya, Ghana, Ethiopia, all countries which the U.S. obviously perceive as anchored for regional engagement and requires focused attention. President Bush also, in his national security strategy, said that the war on terror remains central to his foreign policy, and that in this context, the U.S. will continue to want to translate alliances or translate this into alliances in Africa to promote U.S. strategic security goals. Of course, linked to that are serious concerns about terrorism, and that under the war on terror, the U.S. will want to continue to cooperate with strategic countries in Africa and regions to ensure that peace, stability, especially from the homeland security perspective, is achieved. The National Security Strategy on Africa clearly states that Africa is a quote-unquote playground for terrorists due to the weakening of government and state control and power. And this created, according to the U.S. perceptions, an environment conducive for terrorism to launder funds, planned further strikes and attacks undertaken. So the first area is these security concerns is terrorism, as far as the African continent is concerned. HIV and AIDS is perceived by the U.S. as a critical element that contributes to the further weakening of states and the capacity and ability for effective control. And to this purpose, under the National Security Strategy, again, HIV and AIDS was classified as a national security risk. This classification enables the U.S. administration to disperse the various aid funds that Africa receives. And we can come back to the PEPFAR initiative and so forth. Then regional and intra-state instabilities. Domestically within the U.S., the increased frequency of reported alleged human rights abuses and genocide, quote unquote, on the African continent, particularly in the case of Sudan, has resulted in the formation of various internal pressure groupings that are currently very vocal as well as influential, demanding action from the U.S. administration with regard to Israel and the so-called Sudan sanction legislation. Another issue, apart from security concerns when we look at Africa from a U.S. perspective, is the question of the diversification of the origin of resources. The U.S. regards Africa's oil to be safer to access, of high quality and geographically proximate to the U.S. Sub-Saharan Africa surpassed the Middle East as a supplier of products of as mineral fuel, oil, etc., and mineral wax and so forth, Mr. Chapter 27 of the U.S. legislation. For the first time in 2005, as I say, Sub-Sahara has surpassed the Middle East as a supplier of products in this category to the U.S. The U.S. National Intelligence Council predicts that within less than a decade, the U.S. will be importing more hydrocarbon from the Gulf of Guinea than from the entire Middle East. So obviously there is a very clear interest in South African natural resources. Trade opportunities. The trade between the U.S. and Africa tripled between 1990 and 2006. Mainly as a result of AGOA, the African Growth Opportunity Act. The U.S. is a net importer of 64 strategic and critical minerals and metals globally, and moreover, U.S. dependence on imported minerals is increasing, partly because of increased consumption and partly because of the declining competitiveness of U.S. mineral resources in the international market. Interesting to note that over half of the U.S. imports of chromium and platinum group metals and about one-third of manganese come from South Africa. The U.S. views South Africa as a strategic country, an economic anchor for Africa, and is critical to strengthen Africa's economy. economic and political stability. I mentioned the African Growth Opportunity Act, which has brought benefits to a number of countries on the continent. But there are some flaws and shortcomings as far as they go as concerned. If one looks, although South Africa is one of the beneficiaries, probably with Nigeria and Gabon, of the Africa Growth Opportunity Act, a lot of the products that are exported to the U.S. are minerals or oil. We have not succeeded, and I think this is something that Africa would want to do, that the U.S. should, in the context of AGOA, assist African countries to diversify their economies, to harness more market access granted under AGOA, and broadly to assist African countries to broaden their economic base, that you don't have this narrow interaction of only importing oil, and that only oil benefits from AGOA. I must say again that AGOA has really contributed to trade between between the U.S. and Africa, but there is room for improvement along the lines that I just spelled out. The U.S. has a strong presence on the African continent. It is involved in a number of areas, and I won't be able to touch on all of them, but there's the Millennium Challenge Account, which makes huge contributions to development assistance and technical assistance on the African continent. It currently is running at $5 billion per annum. It may be more now, but it is a mechanism which is benefiting a number of African countries. Also, there is strong support from the U.S. on the NEPAD process. NEPAD remains a high priority for the U.S. with a focus on infrastructure development, and the U.S. has supported NEPAD in a number of ways, and I'll come back to that later, but they have been playing a constructive role there. Then there's the African Fund, about $1 billion through the African World Bank account. That's another mechanism. Of course, I mentioned AGOA, which also, in an African context, benefits Africa, albeit, as I say, overwhelmingly for petroleum products. The next mechanism, PEPFAR, is the so-called President's Emergency Plan for Aid Relief. There's a huge financial commitment from the U.S. For HIV and AIDS and other communicable diseases. And we in South Africa benefit from this. The U.S. Has been very active through PEPFAR in South Africa. And we are and must engage the U.S. to see that the aid channel to South Africa through PEPFAR is in line with our national priorities and objectives. I'll come back to that when we talk about South Africa. And then there's the Women Empowerment Initiative in Africa. It's a $55 million fund, and the main recipients are Benin, Zambia, Kenya, and South Africa in enhancing and furthering gender issues and women, the empowerment of women on the continent. Also, in this context, there is the issue of AFRICOM. And many of you may be aware that on 6 February of this year, President Bush announced the U.S.'s intention to create AFRICOM as a so-called new unified combatant command to promote U.S. national security objectives in Africa and in the continental territorial waters. According to the U.S. administration, this new command would bolster the capability of U.S. partners in Africa and committed the U.S. to consultation with African leaders on the location and manner in which the command can respond to security challenges and opportunities on the continent. There will be a conference that will take place now, 22-23, in Washington, D.C., to which South Africa and a number of its partners have been invited, where the U.S. probably will make available more information on AFRICOM. The idea is that it should be fully operational by October 2008, and its area of operation will include all African states, with the exception of Egypt, which will remain under the central command, so-called CENTCOM, of the U.S. forces. In the meantime, a transition team based at the European Command, EOCOM, in Germany, has begun working on the establishment of this AFRICOM on the African continent. The establishment of this AFRICOM provides the framework for a direct and a protected future U.S. involvement in Africa affairs. And maybe during the discussion, question time, we can talk about that, because SADC has taken a clear-cut position on this, that we do not want other countries to host AFRICOM. But if we go broader on the continent, although there are many countries who support this position, there are countries on the continent who it appears to us, is willing to host AFRICOM. So those are some of the areas of the U.S.'s involvement and constructive involvement in many cases on the continent. But I'd like to come back to that when we have a discussion later. Let me just quickly finish by saying, when we look at U.S.-South Africa bilateral relations and say that, repeat what I said at the outset, the bilateral relation with the U.S. is comprehensive. We have constructive cooperation in many areas, as I said, despite differences on a number of issues. National issues. And then in this context say that government and business and civil society interaction with the U.S. has grown exponentially. We have ongoing interactions flowing from particularly the two interactions that President Mbeki had with President Bush in 2005 and 2006, where we agreed to work not only on expanding our bilateral relations, to work on expanding our economic ties, to work on or cooperate on the Africa agenda. So those two meetings inform the interaction that we have with the U.S. at the moment. We have a forum which meets at least once a year that builds on the guidance or the is informed by what the two principals decided and agreed upon. There are issues, as I already mentioned, issues like working with an African agenda context on HEPARD, working on communicable and infectious diseases, PEPFAR. I think PEPFAR for this year alone, the budget for South Africa was $255 million. And there are more than 300 partners in 9 provinces that benefit from PEPFAR. Our trade and investment relations are growing rapidly. AmCham, who the American Chamber of Commerce brings out a regular report on the involvement of the U.S. Companies in South Africa, reflects a very constructive approach by U.S. companies in doing business in South Africa. As you know, many of them came back after 94, and right now we have 120-130 South Africa, American companies in South Africa with a huge job creation potential, and that I must say that in terms of economic ties, our relations are growing from strength to strength. In fact, it's reached a total of about $80 billion last year. So the U.S. Is among the top 1, 2, 3 of South Africa's not only trading partners, but also investment partners. We have been negotiating with the U.S. There was an intention to bring about a SAFU U.S. free trade agreement, but there were some serious difficulties on some issues, whether it's services or on issues like intellectual property rights and so forth. Where the result is that for the time being, it was decided to set aside the SAFU U.S. free trade agreement negotiations, but rather towards a broader comprehensive trade and investment enhancing agreement, as we call it, and that is now in the making. The increase in exports from South Africa is mostly driven by increases across several products. It's not only raw materials or minerals. We are also increasingly a supplier of primary, not only primary products, but also complex manufactured goods. Thus advancing South Africa's industrial policy that advocates that we add value to our exports. And that's the encouraging thing about our exports to the U.S. The trade balance between the two countries swung in favor of South Africa for the first time in 2000, making the U.S. an important source of foreign exchange earnings for South Africa. We also, apart from trade and economic ties across the board, there's a strong involvement by the U.S. and through U.S. aid and through the various ODA mechanisms to support small and medium-sized companies in South Africa. Very active programs in that regard. We also have constructive cooperation with the U.S. in the field of energy. Westinghouse is very much involved in the nuclear modular reactor, to name an example. We have cooperation with them in sectors like agriculture. Our minister visited there in December last year and agreed on a number of constructive training programs, projects with the U.S. Also in the field of defense, we have constructive cooperation. There are a number of programs, the so-called Africa Contingency Training Program, ACOTA, which provides for training in peacekeeping operations, not only in the region, but also Africa as a whole, to train approximately 40,000 peacekeepers per annum over the next 5 years. Also in the military context, we have 2 or 3 HIV/AIDS related projects that we work with constructively with the US. So I think these are indications of the comprehensiveness of the relationship that we have with the US. In the, as I mentioned, the three areas that was agreed upon by the two principals, building peace and security, expanding democracy and freedom, and spreading economic growth and well-being. In these three areas, we are making good progress. We had on the 7th of June this year, we had the so-called bilateral forum where we took stock of where we stand with our relations with the U.S. in all these various sectors, as determined by the principles and the road ahead. So out of that, just as we move on to the areas for enhancement cooperation, I'm not going to go through all that, but those are the three areas I mentioned. But we list some of the areas, some of which I already mentioned now, that we cooperate. I could also mention that we've agreed with the U.S. and we've had discussions with the ambassador here on cooperation in the field of GIPSA, skills development, and the American Chamber of Commerce is very much involved in facilitating that, and a lot of the American companies are indeed playing a very important role in terms of skills development. Let me conclude by just saying that the existing comprehensive cooperation with the U.S. is going well, but there is still a vast potential for enhanced interaction. As I mentioned, the U.S. foreign policy is strongly based on national interests, looking at it through a very strong prism of the war on terror, and that the manner of implementation of this policy at times causes problems between us and the U.S. in terms of our bilateral relations. Multilateral cooperation is fundamental to South Africa's interactions, and we feel very strongly that the U.S. should be and continue to embrace multilateralism in their foreign policy. It's also important, and the President discussed it with President Bush when we were in Washington, the need for the U.S. and South Africa to interact at the United Nations, particularly in a UNSC context. And that's happening. So, by and large, our relationship is a constructive one, but it remains a complex and a complicated relationship which we have to work on all the time to see that through consultation and that through interaction with the U.S. we can address those issues that cause the irritation in our bilateral relationship. But it's a relationship which is a necessary one. As I mentioned, the U.S. is a superpower. And I saw some figures which is quite mind-boggling if one looks at the GDP of the U.S., which is $13.13 trillion. I don't know how much $13 trillion is. But it's a lot of money. And in fact, states in a very reputable document that with a GDP growth in the U.S. currently of about 2%, and there are some problems now, many of you may have read about the subprime mortgages, which has caused chaos on the market, international market, which could affect the growth of the economy of the U.S. to a degree. It could depress private consumption. We have seen that the U.S. cut its interest rates overnight in order to see that that the economy keeps on growing. Inflation is 2.7%, which is low. Unemployment is relatively low at 4.6%. But the statistics, which was quite mind-boggling, says that with its $13.13 trillion U.S. dollars of its GDP, or the GDP of 13.13, it means that just based on these last quarter figures in the U.S. the U.S. added to the global output an amount that is sustained at that pace, at that growth, for your 1 year of $600 billion U.S. dollars, which is roughly the equivalent of adding one whole new Brazil or Australia to the global economic activity every year. It just reflects the size of the economy of the U.S. There's also predictions that at current economic and population growth rates in the U.S., now it's now about 30% higher than the EU in GDP, that it will be twice the size of Europe's economy in less than 15 years from now, the U.S. So there are other areas, obviously China, India, which are very important to us. But in terms of our bilateral relations, it remains obviously essential for us to engage the U.S., to build on our relations with the U.S., albeit at times not easy, but to expand and consolidate and expand our relations with the U.S. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Masala. The Ambassador said in the slide that the relationship is really good. Not good enough for the U.S. to come to this committee, of course. At least on two occasions. Maybe because you are perceived to be ourselves as the voice of the underdeveloped, and ourselves as a global power. I'm told that that's what the under Secretary of State, the Guy Fraser, said. To quote it directly, it says that, and this was when we're dealing with the UN. The South Africa vote in the Security Council. It is said that she said it has been a rough patch, partly because they see themselves as a global power, or partly because they see themselves as the voice of the developing world. So if you see yourself as a global power, there will be no need for the U.S. ambassador to engage with you. Member, can I open for questions? I'll start with Honorable Seth. Okay, let's go this way. Let's start from Seth and go up the way and come back to you. Okay, we'll go right up.
Thank you. Chairperson, first of all, I want to repeat what you said about the behavior of the U.S. Embassy, because even our question won't be as it was about. But Ambassador, as you are here, and I think you can assist us. Like, number one, I'll touch the issue of HIV and AIDS. I don't know whether it's maybe the role played by the Americans, in particular in Africa, it's the way it's supposed to be. Why I'm raising that fact? Chairperson, you were right, correct, about when you spoke about the underdeveloped country. I think South Africa was the first country to be vocal about the death of the underdeveloped country. I assume that when South Africa reads that matter, the response somewhere, including US, it was AZT. And it was so popular by then, of which some people believe, like myself, we believe that it was another way that when we give you, when we cancel the debt, we'll sell you this medication in this amount, which is very expensive. And then also, here in South Africa, this government was the first one who started to be vocal under the ministership of Mama Nkosi Sonazuma about to popularize the issue of HIV and AIDS. They respond again, instead of solving the underdeveloped country problem concerning the issue of HIV and AIDS, it's ARVs, which are still very expensive. So I don't think that it's proper to say that there is any role which is meaningful. And then you come also about the issue of Africon. I think you were correct to say that most of the countries in Africa, they are very skeptical to host Africon. It is alleged that there is a base in Botswana. I'll say it's an alleged. Therefore, if you calculate correctly, already the base is there, already, which was erected some time ago, early 90s. Then my worry is one, about the approach by the Americans about using force, like the thing which happened in Iraq. Because the people who are going to Iraq, we were told that they were looking for the weapons of mass destruction. But at the end, I don't think there's that anything which was found. At the end, some people were killed, and the killings are still continuing. So that is my worry, because exactly if you are in a relationship with a country which is behaving like that, other countries are perceiving you like another thing. Thank you, President. I'll put it there. I'll come next.
Thank you, Chair. My colleague has preempted one of the questions, but I would like to expand on the question for a more detailed response. There is a great deal of suspicion with regards to the motivation behind the creating of Africon. We've been reading about it in the press, and you also made some statements in that respect, that they claim that it is to promote, the U.S. claims that it is to promote stability, a stable environment, and to promote strengthen security capacity on the continent, and to strengthen civil society, etc. Now, be that as it may, you emphasize that SADC, group of countries, have taken a stand in the position as a collective on the issue of AFRICOM. But it appears that that position is not shared by countries of the center and of the north, Northern Africa. And we have also heard in the press the possibility of Liberia, for example, having offered the U.S. A base position there. And I wanted to know, is there a plan for the African Union to come up with a common perspective and a common position on the issue of Africa? Or is it going to be left to regions to decide on their own? And if that is going to be the situation in a response, not a continental unified response, then how do you perceive that issue becoming a contention and divisive issue for the various regions in Africa?
Clearly, it's a huge economic importance for South Africa to maintain a relationship. But I wonder, and we do have the binational commission, I think either at sort of presidential or deputy presidential level on a regular basis. I wonder if Ambassador Kovler could just lift the curtain a little bit on what actually is discussed at these meetings. You talk in broad terms about some challenges on particular issues. Now, clearly we want to improve our trade situation, tourism, etc., but could you just let us know where the focus lies? I mean, these meetings take place over a day or two. What are big issues for us? Because I want to know more about what we want out of the relationship. I think you've given us a very detailed position on where the U.S. sees us. But apart from trade, which is a given, and economic and the investment, where are some of the details for the issues? What are they, and how much time do they take up, and what progress is being made, if any, on some of our issues for the U.S.?
I thank you, Chair. Ambassador, I just want to repeat this question of AFROCOM, because I see it is a proliferation of armies in Africa whose interests may be in conflict with those of the continent. We are aware that there's AU and as well as the United Nations, which are already involved in an effort to stabilize Africa. Situations and so on, and I don't really see the necessity of AFROCOM as well. Should at least from the country that seems to be interested in the raw material, and then of course, it is a lot of democracy, which may not have been liberatory democracy in our own country. And maybe I should also align myself with the question that was asked before, whether this AFROCOM will then be at some level challenged by the AU, and if not, it is not important that in fact this be encouraged by our own ambassadors that it be done, because it seems to me that it is undermining the unity of Africa, and that is why the US is interested in bilateral relations. Which will definitely undermine the unity of Africa. The other issue that I want to raise is the question of technology. We have got these raw materials here. To what extent is America helping to transfer technology to Africa so that Africans or Africa's people can be capacitated to process their raw materials instead of sending them out as raw materials? And then, of course, there is, I'm sorry, I have to ask this other question, the question of practice processes. We find some difficulties getting resources when we are forced to go to America. Involved with a situation where some of our people have been listed as terrorists. And I've had to deal with quite a number. One case, this particular person operated here in the country as well as in the system. And the American embassy said, well, you go and clear yourself to the police in South Africa, as well as in the system. And he did that. He came back. He still did not get the visa. So I'm wondering to what extent should we observe the issue of reciprocity in diplomacy. Thank you.
Honorable Speaker, I could tell you now that I'm sitting with the case of Minente Doisa, who they refused a visa. And to date, we have not even received an acknowledgement of saying, you, Chairperson, have received your note, you are doing something, we are doing nothing about it. That's how good the ambassador relationship is. as you said initially, that the relationship is very good. That's how good it is. Honorable Mayor.
Thank you. I'd like to first register my views on Dr. Pequot's communication to us before the meeting started. I think the disdain with which the American diplomatic corps has treated this committee with leaves a lot to be desired. And I think, besides writing to him, or to them, it is important that we indicate this to our own Minister of Foreign Affairs. Because we have a particular responsibility in this committee that we exercise oversight powers and responsibility in respect of what the department does. And for us to know that and understand that, we need to interact with them or them directly. I'm saying this only because the most of the questions that I'd like to address today should have been or ought to be directed against or to the ambassador. But I just want to raise two concerns. Another dimension of the AFRICOM consideration is that if we know our history, we realize that in the last 100 years or so, there's not a single international war that has been fought on American soil. That all wars, American wars, whether it's in Vietnam or Korea or wherever, have been fought outside the soil of America. We are not unaware of the Marshall Plan for the resuscitation of Europe and the role of America, but no war fought in America. We are not unaware of the fact that America comes in to do the kind of reconstruction of Iraq when its war was fought in Iraq. So the militarization concept, sir, from our side, does not come out in your presentation. That it is in the national interest of the United States of America's foreign policy option to militarize the world, herself and her allies. So I just want to draw attention to that aspect where your report is a bit remiss. On a lighter note, for us as South Africans, is there any mechanism in determining our foreign policy relations, our relationship with the Americans? Is there a mechanism to consult with COSATU and the ACCP, because they are our allies here, in determining our foreign policy relationships? There is no communist world, so to speak, as such, but with the biggest power on earth, the United States of America. And this is on a lighter note, but it's very important for me.
I think we all appreciate the importance of strengthening relations with the U.S. and the importance of economic links and all the other links. But I'd just like to make two short comments. One is, I think that the ambassador has perhaps slightly underestimated or understated the financial situation. I mean, the expectations now is that the subprime debt crisis is indeed penetrating much deeper, and there will be financial contagion across the world, most likely, and we must take account of that, because this could be quite serious for indeed for the whole of Europe and Africa and the rest of the world. So it's a serious business which perhaps foreign affairs ought to brief itself on about and get us informed on. So the second question is this AFRICOM. My understanding from American academics is that although the U.S. has enormous military power and increasing its capacity, they do have a problem with personnel. The fact of the matter seems to be that Americans are not willing to put their bodies on the line for international military adventures. And that means that the AFRICOM will not be personnel heavy it will be instrument heavy, and therefore exercise primarily a surveillance role in Africa. And all the talk about assisting security and so on is perhaps, I would suggest, a cover for establishing a surveillance activity on the continent of Africa, which could have rather negative consequences. Thanks.
Thank you, Ambassador. I'm glad to have you come to. Question that has been asked already, because I didn't hear what the other people said. But my question on AFRICOM is, do we need AFRICOM ourselves? Why for us? And my other question is perhaps nothing we have you know on, but then it has to do with America. And it's really a policy. Are we in any way, you know, involved in that policy of America? Are we collaborators or in any way at all?
Ambassador, those are the first batch of questions. Maybe in answering those questions, we'll also deal with how strategic is South Africa to the U.S. You've raised the issue of oil resources, and you've raised the fact that the U.S. could source a substantial amount of their energy from the Gulf of Guinea, and you've stated the number of regions that have some mineral fuel for the U.S. And the question is, how strategic in that situation is South Africa to the U.S.? And why has the free trade negotiations not have progressed as much as it has been anticipated? The reservation that America has on SACO issues, if you can touch on those issues. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just say, I forgot to present to my colleague, Fadl Nasruddin, who is the director for the U.S., and I'm going to give him all the difficult questions. Chair, no, thank you. Let me just quickly see where I can touch on all these issues. The first issue that was raised regarding HIV and AIDS and PEPFAR and the U.S. initiative. I can just say that in the discussions that we have had with the U.S., the President has, in his reaction to the media and so on, also in the discussion with the President, with the Americans, has acknowledged the fact that PEPFAR, or initiative by the U.S. to assist Africa and South Africa in particular, was to be welcomed. Now, I must say here that we have had problems and difference of opinion on PEPFAR in the country. I must state that there has been constructive work, but we have had a concern, and obviously my colleagues in the Department of Health would be able to elaborate more detail on that. That, as I said earlier on, it is critical that if we interact with a international partner, be it the U.S., be it the EU, that the assistance A, be sustainable, and secondly, that it be in keeping in line with our national objectives and priorities. So, I don't know enough about PEPFAR's activities in the rest of Africa, but I would imagine that the same kind of problems were encountered in those countries as we encountered here. The U.S. ambassador had an interaction with the deputy president fairly recently, where we discussed these issues, and the deputy president very clearly stated that, yes, we want to work with the U.S., but it must be done in accordance with our objectives and our plans. So that process now, I can say, is underway, that we are going to engage the U.S. to see where, because, as I mentioned, as far as a huge budget, it is involved in 9 provinces with 300,000. And to be honest, I mean, I don't think we always know where the Americans are and what they are doing. So we are in the process of trying to bring all those loose ends together in dealing with them in terms of PEPFAR. But your point is well taken, and that's what's happening with us. Let me just, before I leave AFRICOM to the let me just come to the issues of the bilateral forum. As you may know, we had a BNC with the U.S. After 1994, it kicked off at a very high level. It was the Fed, and there were several ministers involved. I think as we moved on, and you know, one can come back to the whole issue of the number of BNCs we have and commitments we have in terms of bilateral mechanism. But it was decided at the time that should be scaled down to senior official level, and that we should have a number of groupings. There was a working group on human rights, there was a working group on Africa, and so forth. These working groups are meeting from time to time to discuss. But the overarching body that we now have, as I say, is the bilateral forum, which I alluded to, which meets at least once a year to discuss the progress that we are making in the various sectors. And as regards the detail of that, obviously the three broad issues, overarching areas, is we look at our bilateral relations in all the various sectors, and I'll elaborate on that now. We talk about Africa, where South Africa uses the opportunity to state its position, for instance, on AFRICOM. I'll come back to that. And then, of course, multilateral cooperation that on issues such as human rights, at the UN Security Council, how do we work together there? I confess, just looking at the last meeting, we had in the various sectors, for instance, on law enforcement, we have a number of programs running on trafficking persons, anti-terrorism assistance, immigration officials training, there's the Johannesburg police cooperation. There are numerous, and these are a few of the examples of the kind of things that we're doing there. On the issue of counter-terrorism, there is, and South Africa has always committed itself to working within the international arena and within the international organizations in the field of counter-terrorism. And we have been working with the U.S. as we've been working with a lot of other countries on counterterrorism. You are aware of the case where the Dokra brothers were placed on a list of terrorists or whatever they called it at the time. That was very vigorously raised by us. And it was agreed that that matter has been solved in the meantime, but that before such action is taken in future, and that was agreed with them, that there should be consultation. There should be prior information on these things that we can discuss that. These are the kind of things that we discuss as places on the issue of terrorism. We talked to them about disarmament and non-proliferation. There were also issues where we disagreed with the U.S., but we also agreed with them it would be useful that we have consultations before the commencement of meetings, where we don't walk into a conference room and there's a head-on clash between the U.S. and South Africa on specific issues. Obviously, it's
also applies to many other about PFAS. These are the UNSC cooperation, there's military to military cooperation, and I mentioned some of the HIV AIDS related programs, peacekeeping programs that we've been working with the UN. Obviously, there are differences of opinion on a number of these issues. Recently, there was a suggestion by the US to hold a huge information operation in South Africa, communications operation called African Endeavor. We felt in consultation with SADC that it was not in our interest to have that, so it was called off. So these are all the things that we discussed there. I'm just mentioning, I'm just looking, health is the other one, as I said, I mentioned the PEPFAR issue. And energy issues, I mentioned agriculture, there are a number of areas that we sit down and we take stock of where we stand. But this bilateral forum, which meets once a year, is in place to basically, together with the working groups I mentioned, to take forward the things that the principal has agreed on. On the question of technology transfer from the US to Africa, I think that's a very valid point. I think I tried to say when we were talking about AGOA that we are not happy with the way AGOA is functioning at the moment. It did play an important role to enhance trade with Africa, but as I said, it's focused on one, mainly on petroleum, the petroleum issue, the petroleum product, and we would like to see the broadening of it. In fact, also that the U.S. should assist Africa to add value, to create a productive capacity. In fact, those were the issues that were raised at the recent AGOA meeting that we had in Ghana, where South Africa, amongst others, raised the issue, the point that you made, that, and I think it's some of these same issues that we make to China, that we need to have the productive capacity, we need skills development, we need you to help to facilitate Africa to build its economies. So those things are raised, and we did raise in a Goa context, and also on a bilateral context. On the issue of the reciprocity of visas, as I say there, that the U.S. foreign policy, in fact not foreign policy, also domestic policy, there's a huge emphasis on homeland security, that we have ongoing problems and irritations with visas for the U.S. In fact, yesterday, the day before, we heard about three youngsters who were supposed to go from a technical training who were refused visas. Those are the things, and also then in the context of this bilateral forum, we would raise that. But in this case, we decided yesterday we would raise it with the U.S. Embassy and on an ad hoc basis and say, this is not good enough. And we have a lot of problems. I must add, I'm letting the U.S. off the hook, we also have these problems with the U.K., for instance. We have a lot of problems with young people who are going to the U.K. We have it with Canada. So we constantly have to raise these issues with these countries. And we actually now in the Department of Foreign Affairs, of course, in consultation with the Lyon Function Department, Home Affairs, looking at this issue of this process. There's a discussion and engagement now with Home Affairs. And there are all kinds of views on this. Some people feel very strongly that there should be a clear-cut reciprocity. If they want visas from us, we must require visas from them. There are other voices within both departments, ours and I'm sure other departments, who feel we must be careful that we don't so shoot ourselves in the foot, for instance, with countries. Let's say arguments take Germany or the UK, or the UK doesn't provide visas, but Germany, which is a major source of tourism for us. I'm not taking that position, but I'm just saying a lot of arguments are put forward, pro and con, on this issue of reciprocity. But it is an issue that we are looking at this current moment. In fact, we had a discussion last week at the department on this issue.
and it will be taken forward. But it's a very valid point. But as far as the U.S. is concerned, I think based on this latest incident, that we will have to take this up with the U.S. and raise this whole issue of visas again. On the issue that was raised regarding a mechanism for consultations with other actors or stakeholders, and it's a very valid point. In fact, last week we had a meeting where we, I think, earlier discussed our relations with the U.S. and that I raised the issue of the need for more in-depth consultation, not only with other government departments, but with other stakeholders as well, on our relations with the country as important as the U.S. There may be other countries too, but this was an issue that was raised, and we have some ideas as to how we can take that forward. But in fact, the point you made is a very topical one. It was discussed last week, and the minister has some ideas about that. So we will take that forward. On the issue of the financial. Or the implications of what is happening in the U.S., I think, that Honorable Kuroff made. I can just say that we are watching this situation very closely. I think Minister Manuel the other day also alluded to that and gave the kind of the history of what happened with the subprime mortgage, with the subprime mortgage situation on the market since 2001. Because at that point in 2001, a lot of loans were extended to marginal borrowers in the U.S. To the peak of the market about, say, 6 months ago, when these loans to the subprime lenders accounted for about 13% of U.S. Mortgage stock. Of course, then the interest rates in the U.S. went up, and it forced a lot of these borrowers to default. And the impact was initially confined to the U.S., the specialist mortgage lenders that they have in the U.S. But as a result of wider liabilities held by a range of pension and hedge funds in the U.S. and elsewhere, and by foreign banks, so there was a UK bank that is in the process of going under, had to be supported by government. They all went into default, triggering huge losses on foreign markets. What is currently happening is that financial markets are actually reeling under the impact of this situation, and it's affecting to a wide extent the price and the availability of credit. So it is something that even if one considers that, for instance, the U.S. has a deficit of about $804 billion, which is about 5.8% of GDP. But I'm just saying that it's a very valid point that I think the broad implications for South Africa should be watched and for emerging markets. But I think Minister Manuel dealt with this yesterday or the day before in Parliament, if I'm correct. But we are certainly watching that situation.
Capricorn.
Let me just say Capricorn.
you know, I just would like to repeat what the government's position is on that. And I think Minister Lakota dealt with this matter about a week or two ago, where we have consulted with our partners in SADC. And SADC has agreed in principle that we would not host SADC, our host South Africa. Now, I think he also made the point that this was a collective decision by SADC, but there may be countries within SADC that may not necessarily, as a minority, agree with the position. Whether whether as regards to the future location of AFRICOM is concerned, we have heard a lot of rumors, I'd say, because it's not really been confirmed, that they are apart from Tanzania, or was mentioned as one, Ethiopia was mentioned as another one, there was Botswana was mentioned. As of now, we have no concrete information on that. As I mentioned earlier on, there's going to be a conference, a consultative process called by the Americans in Washington, D.C. on the 22nd and the 23rd, where, from what it appears in the documentation we got from them, they are going to give more information on what AFRICOM is going to look like and probably where it's going to be located. But that's the SADC position. The points that were raised regarding the African Union, we raised it with our minister the other day. And South Africa will endeavor to raise this issue. I mean, it's very late in the day now. It's already, and SADC only fairly recently took their position on AFRICOM, because we have to gather information on exactly what AFRICOM is all about. But in the AU context, there seems to be that the majority of countries of the SADC, the African Union, or the great majority, if you will, probably would adopt the same approach as SADC. But from what the minister has said, that there has not been an in-depth discussion by the African Union on this issue. But as I say, it's late in the day, and it could be that very soon it's going to be announced where this AFRICOM is going to be based. And I think the point that Honorable Turok made, it may be that it does not entail putting a lot of troops on the continent. We don't have those details either at this juncture. But the point is just that South Africa and a member of SADC does not feel comfortable with it, because it probably is going to create a facility for intelligence gathering for if you look at what we know about SADC, about AFRICOM at this juncture, that it's going to be a huge interagency presence with various players from the U.S. involved in that. And we just don't feel comfortable with that. It may not be that it's going to entail huge numbers, but it's going to be an injection of a military presence on the continent. We are saying AFRICOM, they can plan an AFRICOM, but perhaps they should keep it where it is now on the European continent. The other argument that has been made by analysts is that it could lead to a further radicalization of the continent. It could lead to a situation where Africa is increasingly or could be the target of terrorist attacks. These are all arguments that were put forward. But our position on that is clear.
And we have not, as far as we have, been consulting with defense on the attendance of this conference in Washington, D.C. I don't know, we discussed it yesterday, I don't know whether what the latest is, we have to find out who of the other members of SADC have been invited to go to Washington, and that we then use that opportunity to explain our position on how we see the conflict. The chairperson's question. Well, I can just say that that Deputy Minister Fahad has, on a number of occasions, expressed South Africa's concern with this practice, and that there are, in the context of this. The foreign policy approach of the U.S., which I alluded to earlier on, based on the war against terror, that there have been a lot of things that we were unhappy about with Guantanamo Bay. It's a situation that we as South Africa cannot live with. There was some of the abuses that took place in Iraq, the rendition things, practices, that is, we have taken a strong stand against that. On the question of the strategic importance of South Africa to the U.S., there's no doubt that, and I think I mentioned that there are countries on the continent that the U.S. obviously see as strategic players and strategic countries. South Africa, with our achievements, the role that, first of all, the economic wherewithal of South Africa, the resources that South Africa has, must be, and as a potential trading and economic partner, must be of strategic importance to the U.S. Furthermore, the U.S. has noted and must have noted the role that South Africa is playing on the continent, and that it's good to be in South Africa's company when dealing with Africa. And that's not only goes for the U.S., it goes for Europe, it goes for countries I deal with. All of them would like to work with South Africa in expanding their relations with the region into the continent. Then the role of South Africa globally, whether it's in the context of the G77 or G20 or and it is clearly in the interest of the U.S. to engage South Africa on those issues. So, for the U.S., South Africa is a strategic country. One can discuss this in a sense, but I think those are the elements of how the U.S. sees South Africa. Just on the second part of the chairperson's question on the free trade agreement between the U.S. and SACU, there were some concerns and there were some issues that the U.S. wanted a much more detailed agreement with some of the same issues causing concern on our part in regards to the part of SACU, similar to what we now have with the European Union on this EPA negotiation. There are issues of access to services. There's the question of these so-called new generation issues. There was the question of intellectual property rights, procurement, and so on, that we as SAPU could not agree with the U.S. We have to protect our interests. The U.S. is a huge economy, and we have to protect our economy. So what we have now done is entered into a broader, more generic trade and investment agreement, which actually will serve as an interim agreement until such time as we are ready to engage the U.S. on these new generation issues that they brought up and which was not clearly in our interest at that point. So we are now working on this broader agreement which will enhance economic interaction that will not affect our interests the way that a free trade agreement was done. As I say, we're battling and drafting now with the EU on the SADC-EPA negotiations on all these issues as well. So thank you very much. I think that covers it.
That's a very important issue on the SADC-EPA. We just went to the EU ACP meeting in Brussels. It's quite an interesting issue. We have an intention as this committee to have a joint session with the DCI to precisely discuss this SADC-EPA problem. And in the same breath, I do not believe that we will meet the deadline of the same session. And the EU Commissioner says that there's no alternative, but we're sure we have to find an alternative. And the two hands, Madrasa and... Okay, one, two, starting with Madrasa, and if you would, one, two, three, four. I don't know the last hand, but...
Thank you, Madrasa. Really, we don't expect you to answer all these questions, because the relevant party is not here. But just to, you may feel like we're belaboring this upcoming issue. But there are legitimate fears in the country. We represent the people as public representatives. Given the strategy of regime change, which has been employed over years by successive U.S. administrations against unfriendly regimes. So for me, that's part of the concern that the people have of South Africa, that regime change is happening in any case, even in situations of where the proximity is a problem. But now, if this military institution is even nearer home, it imposes a more imminent threat against the civilian government. And I think for me that is part of the main concern. And contrary to the principle of the spirit of Nepal, because Nepal's political is based on unappealed by the notion of African problems solved through African solutions with the assistance or invited of partners outside the country. But if you have this kind of plan, which ignores the African Union stand by force, regional stand by force, that are being used precisely during the security issue, now you don't want to partner with all the existing. You superimpose another strategy. Then there are really serious concerns of security, especially about what I want to say, political security against the security. That makes one region or the other perceived to be unfriendly. And those who think that they have no sense of duty. And I think that's what I want to say.
Thank you.
Jefferson. Jefferson, you can push me to the ambassador. Before I was directed to the Embassy of America. You see what there is a thing which is worrying me, you see, about the issue of Zimbabwe. And we're turning a blind eye. Why I'm raising this issue like this? Zimbabwe is our neighbor. And nobody can condone the collapse of the economy in Zimbabwe. But my worry is one. It was said to Alex that Americans also they play a role in psychological warfare by imposing sanctions. You call sanctions. While people are dying, point a finger. Yes, people are dying. People are dying. Why is you who created that beast or that monster? I wanted to, maybe if you can clarify, that is what is the role which they play now? Because what is the key coming in Zimbabwe? People are suffering. Whether you are black or red or brown, but people are dying in Zimbabwe. And then the superpower, they play the role. And then another one, which is worrying sector, about the conflict in the Middle East. You see, this one also is very complicated because I think all of us were concerned about the situation in the Middle East, whereby the Arab, where people are fighting for self-determination, but then the Arab side, the Arab people are not armed. They use means to arm themselves. Why other people are armed? And it is also alleged that some countries like big countries, they are the ones who supply, because some of these arms are being manufactured where in those particular countries. Therefore, if you can clarify us about this, because I saw that you indicated also that there is a meeting coming, maybe you can produce good results.
The Honorable Madasa has actually stolen the word from my mouth when he spoke about the possibility of the African initiative in some way affecting or undermining the new bank initiative. The African state, one of the objectives is to strengthen peacekeeping capacity. Where they will be sort of amplifying or getting more light and addressing the concerns that you are listening to here right now. So what I find strange here is that we established the AU, the AU. Now what I heard there, that is the thing, is that it seems as though Africa is a phase of something, and the matter has not been discussed in depth at AU level. And fully said that SADC has taken a decision as a leader. Now, one would have hoped that AU would be that this matter would have first been discussed at AU level and then filtered down to the various regions so that they could have come up with a common position on that. Now, I think the question is begging, how did this happen then? Because if FA is strategic to the country and if you like to see Nepal succeed, then how is Nepal going to succeed if issues that we can bypass the EU. I mean, you get what I'm trying to say. So maybe he has, the ambassador would have some views as to how this was achieved, that we have reached a state where they've made a complication and that the decision will be made of delay after some good to the thing. Now, whether it's good or bad for us, it might just happen. I'm not advocating that we should say yes to Africa, but it may just happen that Africa is what they say it is. If it is so, then that region which gave the go-ahead will benefit at our expense. You see what I'm saying? Now, this is playing devil's advocate. That on the other hand, being a cautious and suspicious we might just shoot ourselves in the foot as well. So we need to appraise ourselves exactly what this model is. We cannot miss out on opportunity as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is not a question to the ambassador, but a suggestion. In the light of this briefing, with specific reference to AFRICOM, what is it?
Okay.
I was saying in the light of this briefing, with specific reference to AFRICOM and all the concerns around it, maybe I would like to suggest something that in the portfolio committee, we should support the SADC position in as far as AFRICOM is concerned. Thank you.
I wasn't raising a storm, I was just needing your attention. And Ambassador, I feel very sorry for you because we may convey the fact that we are slaughtering or shooting the messenger. Most of these questions are actually could be aptly answered perhaps by the foreign minister in this area. But again, one honorable member said that we're merely trying to represent the feelings that we get on the ground. Substitute the way. In other way, I also asked the question earlier that are the lines of communication between the portfolio committee and foreign affairs strong enough so that they are informed in good time? The questions are there at all times. Maybe we wait too long, and then we come with questions long after the horses bolted out of the stable. So it's that. But I'm going just to basic questions. You mentioned that the forum needs. Once a year, I've already written that question. But who sets the agenda? Is it written from the modus operandi in terms of bringing issues to the table? Is it a one directional way or a reciprocal way of doing it? And then is there a mechanism to measure the periodically measure the achievements coming out of this forum? And the questions also indicate again that there seems to be gaps in terms of our communication, etc., and the way we operate. Would one be wrong to say there is too much opening in terms of the Department of Foreign Affairs taking initiative without adequately sounding out what the feelings are of government, of the general citizenry in this country? And again, communication are the people in both partners, America and Africa, South Africa, well informed about this initiative, despite perhaps their spouse foreign affairs policy. There seems to be quite a number of nebulous areas around that. And of course, I was also going to ask the old question, I think you answered it partly, about the visa retrospective. Do we experience the same thing from the alleged, culprits? Do we experience the same thing when we have the problems with them? Do they have the inconvenience or suffer the inconvenience that they suffer, that they need out? And Africa itself, on South Africa and SADC, it seems to me, I just want to be corrected, that's my perception. It seems to me we are as helpless as anything when it comes to Africa. Something that seems to be an imposition from outside ourselves, namely America. Is that perception correct? And if it is correct, how can it be tackled? Thank you. Ambassador, maybe before you deal with this question, just to quickly between the administrative problem that we're picking up. Remember, there are a copy of minutes that were sent to your offices, basically summarizing what the committee has been doing or what exactly came to the committee. I'm told that we should officially process those minutes. But basically, those minutes deal with the discussions that were there before the committee. It's a meeting of the 14th where it dealt with the political dynamics in West Africa. It's a minute that dealt with the South Africa foreign policy. A briefing from the deputy minister.
Minister on NIPAS, a briefing that we received on the vacancy. This was a briefing that we initiated after we came back from the department. And colleagues dealt with China, South Africa, and then India-Brazil issues. And then the other report relates to, it's a minute related to the DAFU conference that colleagues attended. Can you agree that this minute, unless there's a fundamental issue, because I went through them just reporting on discussions that took place. Because when I read them, I didn't find anything, just a reporting of the discussion. Agreed?
Agreed.
Thank you. Ambassador, can you then pick up on those questions?
Yes.
And maybe when you deal with them, if you could also deal with the question of whether in our bilateral, do we raise the continued violation of Cuba? Because you said that one of the working groups in the bilateral deals with human rights. And I've never seen violation of human rights like I've seen on those prisoners. I've never seen the violation of human rights as a continued subjugation of Cuba into blockades and sanctions and so on. Do we raise these issues as issues of international concern and that increase insecurity and anxiety from ordinary people? Do we raise the fact that some of the problems, the worst problems we have today, are actually part of the creation by the superpower itself? If you look at the history of Afghanistan and you look at the reason why the Soviets left there and the coming in of Taliban, today it's the father fighting the child. Because they gave birth to that situation. And when we are told that the world that we should fight the evil, but the creator of the evil does not say to us that I have created evil and therefore it's beyond my own means to control. If you go to the problems now in Palestine, Hamas, let's go to the issue of Hamas. So I'm saying that sometimes that you are aided and we're mobilized to fight international terrorism. And when we put our shoulder on the wheel, the same leader turns the other way, comes behind us, and deals blown up. If you look at Nicaragua, of course the current elections change and preserve what happened. But if you choose to ask today what happened to Nicaragua, you can trace it back to the White House. If you go back to the continent, RENAMO, MNR, it trace back how Sabine was sustained throughout. And all of this, so this is a problem. Are we raising these issues in our bilateral? Of course, I do not agree with the fact that we must stand on the top roof of the child. But at a discussion level, do you raise this concern that it's important for the U.S. to shape its foreign policy in such a way that it has a human face? And to what extent, if you put your money, do you think that the elections in the U.S. will unfold? Does Hillary stand a chance? Because to the extent that the treaty in pursuit of American policy, it's pursued in a very
a humane way. The poet, I don't think that the poet has changed under Christie, but he was able to take the world with him. And the current church was unable to do that. And for that, maybe we need another Christie to try and change the face of the American foreign policy. Ambassador, you can comment on those questions.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me just talk about whether we can, you know, on AFRICOM, the points that were made, I think, are all legitimate. I think that just listening to some of the inputs and the not only today, but and incidentally, we had an interdepartmental working group, defense, intelligence, people, foreign affairs, where we discussed the question of AFRICOM and the implications for South Africa and the region and the continent. That a lot of the information that we received from other African countries and the inputs we got and reports is that there are a number of factors, but this is one in the interest of time. Is the question that is asked that in the case of Iraq, for instance, where the U.S. has sent in troops, and I'm not comparing that to AFRICOM, but it's a military involvement and a military engagement. And the question that comes from Africa is that, is the world today a safer place after the Iraq? And I think if you analyze the situation, that you must come to the conclusion that in fact, the world is not a safe place. I mentioned earlier on that Iraq was turned into a rogue state, safe state, with increased radicalization, and the implications of that. In fact, there was a very interesting study that I read yesterday, the day before the Institute of Studies in the UK, that said that it actually boosted the chances for terror around the world, that it strengthened the hands of Al-Qaeda, we probably will see further attempts to attack in the West. So basically, do we need that kind of military presence? And whatever the reasons are that put forward by the Americans, and if you read the objectives of AFRICOM, it looks good on paper. But do we need? This is one example. Do we need an expanded presence of the U.S. on the continent? To come to the point of perhaps we were. We should have discussed this earlier. I'm not talking about the region, talking about the African Union. This is not new. The Americans have been talking about this for quite a while. It's not a new thing. In fact, Americans have had delegations that visited numerous countries on the African continent, explaining AFRICOM and what it entails and so forth. Unfortunately, it was never discussed in detail at the African Union. Never discussed in detail. But the result is that there is, I think, a common position insofar as that the majority of the countries on the continent probably oppose AFRICOM, but there are others who are willing to offer their services. We arranged it last week again with the minister, and it's late in the day, and we thought that in terms of this conference that takes place, our own sense was to perhaps have a discussion with our SADC partners, those that we've invited, and SADC collectively on participation, and then to take a common position in Washington on this issue and explain our concerns on AFRICOM.
as I said, I'm not quite sure what the final decision is on our participation, but that's what our feeling. So I'm going to, you know, this thing obviously, and I would really feel, based on today's discussion, that the portfolio committee should further pursue this matter. As I said, we have a interdepartmental committee. It was also, of course, in the context of the cluster, that may be late in the day, but that we have a further engagement on this matter. Let me just say then, on the question of Zimbabwe, that we have consistently raised this issue of sanctions in whatever form against Zimbabwe. As a matter of fact, last week I was with Deputy Minister Fahad, where we raised with the European country the fact that they said, well, you know, we have these sanctions, but it doesn't hurt the man and the woman on the ground, because it actually aimed at President Mugabe and these people around him. And our consistent position on that has been that it may be the case that there are not economic sanctions, as is in fact the case. There are not economic sanctions, but not directly, but indirectly, there are economic sanctions. If you say, constantly say, you know, this country and its leader is so bad, that's, you know, the psychological effect of that on people, who's going to do business? If you know that the leader can't travel or he can't do this, we've always consistently been in favor, and that's the message that we've conveyed inter alia to the U.S. on sanctions, whatever form. There's a psychological effect and impact of sanctions, which is hurtful. And particularly at this juncture, you know, where the president is busy with these mediation efforts, which it's interesting to see in the papers this morning, there's progress. There was a president last week when the German ambassador came, but the president actually gave him an overview of some of the things that were happening. There is progress. And yet, at this stage, that there should be a responsibility on the part of the international community to turn down, to give this effort or this endeavor of SADC or the president on behalf of SADC a fair chance. And it is encouraging to see this morning, listen to the president the other day, that there is progress and it's going well. It's similar to the report that he gave to SADC the other day. So that question of the psychological impact, no matter what form the sanctions take, there's a psychological effect on a country. No one's going to invest there if they know that the sword is hanging over the country. Let me just say something about the Middle East. I said, I think initially, that the U.S. has declared finding a solution to the Palestinian-Israel issue as one of its priorities for this year. And the U.S. has announced that in November there will be an international conference to restart the so-called, the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Up to now, we have very little information as to how this is going to be put together. There's no clarity on the agenda. A lot of the Arab countries around in the region are not sure or fairly skeptical of this process. Apparently, President Hamas and Prime Minister Olmert recently agreed that they would put together some working groups to prepare for the talks on how to take this process forward. The Saudis, who played an important role in their peace initiative together with some of their partners, are also indicated to us that they would like to know how this thing is going to be structured, who's going to be there, It's clear that that the U.S. would not want a player like Syria there. And the other thing that concerns us is that obviously is the split that is taken place within the Palestinian ranks. That's problematic, and that I think the President and Deputy Minister Saad, my minister, have said that on numerous occasions. It's important that we work towards unity in Palestinian ranks. You cannot isolate Hamas. You can't. You've got to bring them back into the process. There will be no peace in the Middle East, and there will be no peace in Palestine, Israel, unless you bring Hamas back into the process. We cannot afford a Lebanization of the Palestinian society, and we've got to get away from it. And to think that you can solve the Palestinian issue, the Israeli issue, without the involvement of Hamas, it's a pipe dream. So they'll have to go back to the drawing board on this. And Hamas will have to be brought back. And obviously, we must urge Hamas to adopt a approach of moving closer to Fatah. It's very important. I think what would be disastrous if, and that's why I'm saying, in that process, it should be as wide as possible, that you bring in all the key players, including Syria. And that's one thing that I think the U.S. will start to learn, have to learn, that you've got to not only talk to your friends, you've got to talk to your enemies. And in this context, we would not like to see that a situation develops around the Palestine-Israeli issue, that you have a regional struggle between, on the one hand, Iran and Syria and Hamas on the one hand, and then on the other side you have the U.S., the so-called moderate Arab states, and Fatah. You'll have to bring everyone into this process to find a comprehensive, just, and durable solution to the Middle East. So basically, we're waiting to hear. We welcome the initiative that there's a renewed attempt to find a solution, but it's going to, we would like to see the details, to see how this thing is structured to make it meaningful. On the issues that the chair raised, I can just say, you know much better than I do what our position is on Cuba, and we have dealt with it in a bilateral context, but mainly Cuba is dealt with in a multilateral context through the Human Rights Council. That's where we engage through the Human Rights Council. As I say, not also on a bilateral level. We have raised it with the U.S. The Deputy Minister has done that, and with other with the EU for that matter. There's a variation in views within the EU. Spain, for instance, takes a much more positive approach, and some of the other EU countries. But we've raised Cuba, and we will continue to do that. As far as Afghanistan, Iraq is concerned, the points you made there, I concur with. We have said consistently that we. With what's happening in Iraq now and Afghanistan, we would like to see stability return to those countries. We would like to see sovereignty return to those people. And that's in broad terms is our position. As far as Latin America is concerned, there again, I think that we would want to see the U.S. Engage Latin America. And listen and talk. It's important that obviously there are partners in Latin America, but we need to have an approach and a positive and a constructive approach to the region as a whole, and to listen and to discuss and to talk in addressing the challenges that face Latin America. I think on the question of the bilateral forum, Honorable Samane, what we do with that forum is, as I think I indicated early on, the issues of the themes to be discussed at that forum is informed by what the principals decided that we discuss. So there are set themes for that bilateral forum, and we have from time to time, we have interdepartmental, interdepartmental reviews on taking this process forward. What I would like to add, and the point I made earlier, is that that perhaps we need even better coordination and consultation amongst government departments. Maybe with civil society, other stakeholders that we need to consult on a theme or issue as important as our relations to the U.S. But as I mentioned, we have discussed that with the minister, and obviously for it will be an issue that also we would like to convey this to our principals on the need for a more ongoing interaction with the portfolio committee on the specific issue. There are others, but I think this is one that we would probably need to have continued
Thank you, Masala. Thank you very much. I still believe that we will one day find the opportunity to engage the ambassador of the U.S. I would be sad if the chase one country could come to me and say our ambassador refused to engage with them. And I think that in an event that we are told that our ambassador refused to engage with politicians, particularly parliamentarians, in any country, I think this parliament will be saddened by that, and we'll seek to get a reasonable explanation of why, because we think that the duty of the ambassador that represents us is to engage the population of that country, to explain ourselves, to explain our policies, to explain and build friendship on our behalf. That's basically his duty. And once he decides that he's not going to build those relations, then that raises concern. And I'm raising this because I believe that all our ambassadors in all the countries, their duty is to build that relationship, is to communicate to people that this is what South Africa thinks, this is what makes South Africa, and these are the difficulties that South Africa confronts. And I just believe that the U.S. will see the opportunity in speaking to South Africans. Because speaking on this committee, you're not only speaking to the 30 members that sit around this table, but you're speaking to South Africans in their numbers. I think they are about 47 million. So you have the opportunity to speak to each and every South African, if that's the case. I still hope that they will find the opportunity to do that. And of course, if they are enthusiastic, we'll find time in the committee to put them in to discuss issues that we think are of mutual concern. In any marriage that you have two parents not willing to speak to their children, you have a problem. In this case, I find it strange that they have a good relationship with the U.S., but they find it inappropriate to speak to politicians that make the policies, that does the oversight in this good relationship. The good relationship that they have with government is influenced by these politicians, but they find it prudent not to engage those politicians. This is a sad, I must say, state of things. With those, Ambassador, thank you very much. I'm sure that there's a finger lunch outside and members are invited to do that.